Chris Kershaw tipping pitches. CJ, how does the hitter see that and take advantage?
Well, first and foremost, Chris, if it did happen, it always happens when the pitcher is in the stretch. Rarely can you pick up pitches when a guy is thrown from the windup, and that's what we saw in that seventh inning.
Oh, shit. Are we live?
We're live. The first bi-coastal episode of Tipping Pitches.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. It's been a struggle to get this set up.
It's been more than a struggle.
it took us like half an hour to figure out how to use this thing.
I'm like afraid to like press the nuclear button on like any of anything that's going on in this recording setup, but
I know. I'm like hunched over my microphone, like hands like in the air trying not to touch anything and not set anything up.
I'm sitting on the floor. Yeah, so how's Oakland, dude? Oakland's... I haven't seen your face in like 5 days. It's like too long for us.
Yeah, it's weird. Well, I thought we were going to do like a Skype video for this too. So this is even weirder. We're just like talking on the phone for an hour about baseball.
We're like the Effectively Wild. Like they've only done one podcast together and this is our only podcast apart.
Yeah, it's pretty good though. I think we're gonna make it work. We sound good.
I certainly hope so. I hope like an animal doesn't like run through and wreck my recording situation right now.
Yo, it's hotter than hell in Oakland right now.
What especially does that even mean? Like 74?
No, it's like around 80, a little bit higher, but it doesn't get that hot. We don't have air conditioning here. So I like turned the fan off in the room so that we wouldn't have like background noise. And now I'm just sitting here like soaking in my own sweat, like hoping I can keep my train of thought.
Wait, you don't have air conditioning? That's wild.
Yeah, not really. Like, we don't need it.
It's like 70 and like breezy here. We have the windows open.
Oh man, that's nice.
Yeah, it's really nice. It was a perfect night for baseball tonight. So we're recording this on Sunday night, August 27th. And tonight was Bark at the Park night at the local Trenton Thunder, the Yankees AA affiliate, which is, as I tweeted out. So, yeah, like I said last episode, this is actually what the four people that are listening to this actually do want to listen to me read out my tweets. But I was essentially like... That's my this Venn diagram is a circle situation is Bark at the Park night at a ballpark.
You just read out a meme that you tweeted.
This is next level shit, man.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I picked up some AA ball, but you went like one step further and you picked up an indie ball game.
Yeah, we got that indie ball game, the San Rafael Pacifics versus the Sonoma Stompers, made famous by one Ben Lindbergh and one Sam Miller in the book The Only Rule Is It Has to Work, which you have read. I still have yet to read. But yeah, that was a really cool experience. Beautiful little ballpark. I mean, it was a beautiful night for baseball too. And yeah, that was fun. It was fun to get out there and see some not affiliated baseball.
I got like lightweight hype when I saw you like at an indie ball game, which is ridiculous because it's indie ball.
Yeah, like why?
But yeah, that must have been fun. So now that we're done bantering about minor league baseball, which, you know, people hardly even care about like more than five major league teams, and we're talking about
yeah,
like three or four teams no one's ever even heard of.
I feel like we struggle to keep people's interest when we talk about the A's and the Mets. Like, who cares about their seasons in mid-August at this point?
You know what I was even more mad about? Like, this is going to get really inside baseball, no pun intended, but... The Trenton Thunder, the Yankees AA affiliate, have Dominic Acevedo on their team, and he's out on the 7-day DL, which means I guess he got a concussion, which is like a very specific injury for him to get for me not to be able to see him. And also Newsday we had this story about how Jorge Mateo, who was I believe a shortstop for them earlier in the season, was just like tearing it up. He was hitting like 480 for like a month.
Yeah,
like Jose Altuve shit. And of course he was involved in one of those deadline trades, so I didn't even get to see him either.
And now he's our shortstop of the future.
Is he on the A's? Was he in the Sonny Gray trade?
Yeah. Now he's playing for our AA affiliate, the Rockhounds.
Oh damn! Well, shout out to him. All right, let's move on to some weird things that happened. So this first thing is something that happened like it feels like forever ago now, because news cycles just move like 10 a day.
Yeah, well, we were bummed because it happened like the day, literally the same day that we recorded our last podcast. Like that afternoon, this news came out.
I was like, yo, let's record like a quick little like 10-minute sidebar, and we just never got around to doing it.
What you're referring to is the umpire protest, which is sweeping the nation right now, obviously. I mean, it's all over Twitter. It's all over the national news. I mean, this is a big one, you guys.
I'm rolling my eyes literally so hard. So if you aren't familiar with this, then you are not Twitter, but the umpires wore white wristbands, which is like, come on, optics, guys, to protest their what they called like verbal abuse. So they called it a silent protest, but they also announced what it was. Like, I was reading an AP Wire story about it like the day that it happened. So I don't really know how silent that protest is. But it eventually led to a meeting with Commissioner Manfred like 36 hours later. So like that just goes to show like white people protesting get what they want. But
yeah, so true.
Do you have like any quick 30-second thoughts on this?
It stemmed from an incident involving Ian Kinsler, the second baseman for the Tigers, and Angel Hernandez.
He's still playing?
Yeah, right? I don't even know. But he was ejected for arguing balls and strikes. As you know, that's what happens. You argue balls and strikes, you get ejected. But that wasn't the issue. He got into a heated argument with Angel Hernandez, but after the game, he came out and literally said he's changing the game. He's speaking of Hernandez. He's changing the game. He needs to find another job. He really does. I'm not mad at him. He just needs to go away. When it becomes blatant like this, there is a problem. All right, frankly, I'm on Hernandez's side. That's a dick thing to say. Like, I know we all have our issues with Major League umpires. I know the fans do. I'm sure that players and coaches do as well. But I don't know. That feels like something that you don't come out and spew about to the media. Like, maybe you should have put together a better at bat. Maybe don't get rung up on balls and strikes next time. Like,
maybe retire.
Yeah. That's so true. Like, I'm sorry that the Tigers are in the midst of like a very middling season, but this is not the time to be kicking up a ruckus. Do I think it was an overreaction on the umpire's part?
Okay, here's my thing about this though, is that like you signed up for this, right? Like that's like going out there and getting mad that like a late game reliever is throwing 99 to you. Like that's just this part of the game. If you're an umpire, you have to know that no one's ever going to like you. Like you're making triple digits to just subjectively decide whether someone's out or safe or it's a ball or a strike. Like you can get over it, dude. Your life is not that hard. You're not being abused.
Yo, yeah. Sorry you're not a referee for soccer or football in Latin America who literally receive death threats and are like attacked on the field if they make a call that doesn't go the right way. Like, chill. Sorry that a player sometimes gets upset with you for a call he didn't agree with.
I get like drawing a line in the sand with like players so that they're not just like turning around and cursing you out and like saying terrible things about your mother and your wife or whatever after every bad call that you make. But at the same time, it's like, come on. Like, this baseball is one of the easiest games to officiate, in my opinion. Like, think about how much faster moving basketball is. Like the charge block call in basketball, or like the last 10 seconds of the NBA Finals game 7. Like, what if you mess up a call there? Or think about like you brought up, like a football official like in South America, or like a line judge who calls the wrong offsides call and takes away like the game-winning goal for whatever team, and they literally mob and kill you on the field. Like, it's not that serious.
Yeah, it really isn't. Also, the way they phrase it, like, to protest quote-unquote escalating verbal attacks, like, come on, dude. Like, sometimes a player gets upset with you. Like, it was never that big a deal to begin with. And it's like a running joke among fans that umpires are not very good, but none of us, like, dislike you as a person. Like, I wouldn't wish ill upon you or your family. I wish you'd give us a call once in a while, but I don't know. This feels like a bit of an overreaction. You're not the new Colin Kaepernick here.
They're mad about escalating verbal assaults. Like, or whatever they call it, or whatever you just read out, like, they don't do anything to de-escalate it. Like, they are much more often the ones escalating the situation. Like, you know what you did by tossing someone for getting kind of mad? You escalated the situation. You toss Adrian Beltre for moving the on-deck circle. You escalated that situation.
Like, yeah, that one's
that
on
was
you.
A funny one, but, like, there are other ones that get worse, and that brings us into another topic that we were going to banter about real quick before we get into our semi-researched segment. that Yankees brawl the other day. Like, the umpires did nothing right during that. Like, they escalated that situation by not handing out warnings before it got too late.
Yeah, I think it was, who was the pitcher who initially got tossed for that? Was it Conley?
Tommy Canley. We just said it three different ways.
Yeah, of course.
Was it Conley? Canley.
Oh. Okay, Canley. He was ejected without any warning whatsoever. Totally unwarranted. I think in any person's opinion, that feels like an umpire who's trying to make a show out of it and make an example out of this player. I mean, whether or not you decided that that was a purposeful hit by pitch, that's so out of bounds. I mean, that's the type of thing where you're trying to shift the spotlight to you and make it the sort of thing where you are directing. I mean, umpires are not there to direct how the game goes as far as, like, I mean, I guess they are technically, but you shouldn't be making calls that significantly alter any sort of outcome of the game that, you know, wouldn't otherwise be there.
I think, like, the game should be on cruise control and the umpires should only need to, like, steer here and there. Like,
yeah, it's a better way of finding it.
that's not what they did in that situation. And generally I try to never side with Joe Girardi, but in this instance, like, you have to come out and defend your pitcher if he gets ejected after you don't even get a warning. Like, that's what I was so mad about in 2016 when Syndergaard threw behind Chase Utley, because he didn't even get a warning. And you're going to eject the starting pitcher in, like, the second inning without even warning him? No harm, no foul by Canley hitting one dude. Like, that's just baseball.
Yeah, unless it's
another instance of the umpires not understanding that that's just baseball. Like, you're gonna get yelled at, people are gonna hit each other. Like, deal with it. You signed up for this.
Unless it's the type of thing where they come in and the two teams have bad blood, like the day before they had a big brawl or something like that, or everyone is on edge because someone knows that someone's going to get plunked, and you warn the two teams ahead of time, you know, before the game, and be like, look, I don't want any bad shit going down here, then sure, fine. But this was, as far as I know, the Yankees-Tigers rivalry is not one of the hottest ones in baseball. like on any other day, I would not even notice a hit by pitch. Players get hit by a pitch all the time. So yeah. I guess it's a judgment call on the part of the umpire whether or not it was intentional. But frankly, unless it's clear, I don't think you're supposed to be making that call.
Yeah, so just a quick rundown of the results of that. Miggy got 7 games because he went all Floyd Mayweather on Austin Romine.
Yeah.
Sanchez Elgarry got 4 games because he came in, dude, like a bat out of hell, and just started throwing sucker punches.
He was going ham. He was just going in there, man.
Yeah, and then Romine got 2 games, which I don't know if I understand that. He got shoved and then punched by Cabrera. What was he supposed to do?
Yeah.
Just run the other direction? I never really understand that.
I still want to know, like, what the conversation was that sparked that. Like, you know, you're jawing at each other, and Miggy's like, hey, why'd your pitcher just throw at me? And Romine was probably like, I don't know, that one got away. And Miggy was like, that's unacceptable, and shoves him. Like,
No. Romine was probably like, yo, dude, you're hitting 220. Yeah. Romine was probably like, yo, remember when you won the Triple Crown? Damn, we've come a long way. Alex Wilson got 4 games. He was the Tigers pitcher who came out afterwards and said, yeah, I hit him on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, that was going to happen. I mean, also, he didn't even need to say that to show. Like, after there'd already been 2 brawls, and Alex Wilson's like, no, we're going to have the last laugh, and just hits him. It was like, it was so blatant. Like, if anyone gets the clear suspension, it's him.
And then the Tigers manager, Brad Ausmus, got 1 game, which is like, he could probably use a day off. So
in the middle of August, he's like, I'm going to chill in my hotel. There's air conditioning in there.
All right, I would be remiss if we didn't even mention Rich Hill at all. So I know you were watching that game. I was out somewhere, so I was just following along on my phone. Can you take me through the emotions of that real quick before we move on?
Well, the thing is, when watching a no-hitter or a perfect game, if it's through like the sixth inning, you're kind of like, all right, we got three innings left. There's plenty of baseball left to play. You try not to get too excited about it. By the seventh inning, if he's got one through seven innings, that's the point where you're like so on edge. Like, I don't care who the pitcher is, whether he's on the Dodgers or he's on the Red Sox or he's on the friggin' Giants, you know?
Nah, dude. Fuck that. He's on the Royals. Break that shit up. Bunt single.
Yeah, so true. Not to mention Rich Hill's story. I mean, how far he's come, and he's what, like 35 now? How he had a whole, turned his career around like 2 years ago. I can't really say he's a part of A's history or anything like that, but he spent a half a season with us. He certainly got us a good return, so I'll thank him for that. But oh my God, it was so heartbreaking. I mean, first of all, Logan Forsythe booted the ground ball to him in the ninth inning, which broke up the perfect game, which hard play off the bat. You don't blame him for that. You got to feel bad for him because you know that he's almost sitting there being like, dude, I hope you don't throw a no hitter because then I'm going to be the guy who lost you the perfect game.
Yeah.
And then Harrison hitting the walk-off in the 10th inning. Oh, my God. My heart just broke into a million pieces right there.
Especially since Rich Hill is not making it past the 7th inning for the rest of the season or maybe his career.
Yeah, seriously. It's like earlier this year, he can't get out of the 6th inning and like throws 100 pitches. He threw a Maddux in 10 innings and still couldn't get the no-hitter or anything like that.
Yeah, that's rough.
Oh, man. Thinking of you, Rich Hill. I got you in my heart the rest of the season.
It's so funny because he looks like he's hungover literally 100% of the time.
Yeah, like...
I think that's just like his body and his face. Yeah. Like, I don't actually, you know, I don't know anything about Rich Hill and his drinking habits, but he just looks like... He just looks like he just took like a bottle to the face.
This podcast like borders on slander, like in most of its episodes. Like we just make shit up about people. Alabama, Arkansas, I do love my mom, pa, not the way that I do love you. Well, holy moly, real life, you're the apple of my eye, girl, I never loved one like.
So let's move on, transitioning. So this next segment that required a little bit of research, you know, more research than we generally do for most of our segments. But it was your idea, so I'll let you explain what spawned the idea in your brain.
Yeah, well, about, I don't know, a couple weeks ago, I was searching through A's player statistics, because what else are you going to do in the middle of August except try and find like one thing that makes you feel good about a mostly lost season? And so I was looking through like Ryan Healy's player statistics, and I noticed that he was hitting like 270 with like 22 home runs and had posted like zero WAR on the season. And I was like, that's
impressive.
That's kind of impressive. You got to be pretty bad. I know his defense is like not good, very below average. So, but that kind of sparked something in my head. I was like, I wonder what is like the best surface level season where like those surface level numbers look good, but when you like dig into it, the player is still having a really bad season. And so this spawned this idea that we'll get into about what are some of the weirdest seasons that players have ever had, right? Like strange statistical anomalies that we've never really seen before, or if we've seen it, like this is just the absolute weirdest of its kind. So you and I each spent some time doing a lot of really deep digging on Baseball Reference, probably too much time, getting too familiar with the play index, just to try and find three seasons each of what are strange outliers in baseball history that, I don't know, you look at the numbers and you just scratch your head and you can't figure them out. So I don't know, do you want to start it off and talk about the first season that you came up with?
Yeah, so I'm not going to guarantee that there is not a weirder season, because baseball is a game that has been played for a very, 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 very long time.
Really? That long?
Yeah. So funny enough, I was like, the first thing I did, I was like, I'm going to look at who made the most errors in a season. So I like went to the Baseball Reference leaderboards, and there are only like two seasons after 1933, and then I was like, "Oh yeah, well they just like didn't use gloves before then."
Yeah.
It was like dating back all the way to like 1860, like some dude made like 160 errors in a season. And I was like, good God.
Yeah, and then they were like, maybe we should try not using our bare hands to feel these scorching line drives that are hit at us.
So my first season is the home run king himself, Barry Bonds, 2004 season. So I wrestled with myself a little bit between which Barry Bonds season to choose, but I knew I wanted to pick a Barry Bonds season because his stat lines are ones that you will never see for a different player unless Giancarlo just like continues to do what he's doing right now. So I ended up choosing 2004, and that was the year that he set the walks record with 232, which is just like, just process that number for a second. 232 walks.
That's like more hits than Jose Altuve had last season.
He was 39 in this season. He had 617 plate appearances, and only 373 of them were official at-bats.
Yeah, that's insane. It's still one of those things that you can look at those numbers every time, and everyone knows that Barry Bonds is, you know, steroids or not, one of the greatest hitters of all time. And then you go and look at his Baseball Reference page, and you're like, holy shit, he's still somehow even better than you imagined he was.
I want you to guess what his OPS was. Do you know this already?
No, I don't think so.
I want you to guess.
1,400.
Nice, 1,422.
All right, yeah.
That's ridiculous. His OBP was 609.
Jesus Christ.
That's literally like, if he doesn't get on base, you're like, what? Is the natural order like upset forever? Like, am I ever gonna, what's happening? So like, I remember last year, or it was either last year or during Bryce Harper's crazy 2015 year, where like through the first 3 months of the season, Bryce had hit more home runs than he had strikeouts. Barry Bonds in 2004 hit 45 home runs and only struck out 41 times.
That's ridiculous.
He essentially struck out once every four games.
Oh my God. And homered the same amount. I mean, come on.
Exactly. So, I just wanted to nominate one Barry Bonds season, and scrolling through Baseball Reference on the Barry Bonds page, that was the one that popped out the most to me. Even though obviously the 73 home run season is just ridiculous on so many different levels, I just felt like I had to talk about the walks and the OBP and the OPS over 1,400.
Yeah, that's insane. It really is one of those numbers. You hear it every time and you still can't really, you can't even wrap your head around it, because the best hitters of this generation, like you look at Mike Trout and you're like, holy shit, we're never going to see another player like him. And his OPS is still like 1,100. Like Barry Bonds was somehow way better.
Yeah, it's obscene. All right, so give me your first person.
Well, actually it makes for a nice segue, because as everyone knows, Barry Bonds certainly got intentionally walked his fair share of times, but I was kind of curious on the intentional walk game on the other side of the ball. And so I just was mostly just scrolling through the leaderboards, looking at pitchers who had intentionally walked the most batters in one season. And the number that I came across was just really strange and out there. So in 1974, Gene Garber, who at the time was playing for the Kansas City Royals, this was, I think, like his third season, but this was his first or his like second full season. He intentionally walked 24 batters as a reliever, and that's in 76 innings. He intentionally walked 24 people in 76 innings. He had 44 walks on the year. So his walks per nine that year, 5.2. His intentional walks per nine, 2.84. He was literally intentionally walking a guy every third inning. That's so bizarre to me. I mean, intentional walks really kind of were on the rise, like in the 60s and 70s. They peaked in like the late 60s. People were doing that all the time. But the majority of the leaders atop that list are starting pitchers, obviously, just by sheer volume. You know, you might intentionally walk 23 guys in 170, 180 innings. But he was, his first game of that season, he came out and intentionally walked three guys. What What is the strategic thinking behind that sort of thing? Like, is it a managerial situation where you really just think you're gaining that much of an advantage? Do you not trust him that much?
I think, like, I mean, I obviously don't know the, like, lefty-righty splits of his intentionally of his intentional walks, but, I mean, back then the bullpens were not as big. So, in theory, like, maybe he was intentionally walking people to get to another righty or something. I don't know if he was right-handed or left-handed, but, you know, maybe they just didn't have, like, an extra loogie or, like...
He was, like, a right-handed middle reliever who usually pitched, like, you know, one or two innings. So sometimes went a little longer, but I feel like he probably was not the only righty they had in their bullpen where they were like, no, we're going to bring you in, but you literally can't face this lefty hitter. He had one game that year, which happened to fall on my birthday, where he came in and faced two batters. He intentionally walked the first guy and then gave up a walk-off to Joe Torre the next. So came in, literally they brought him in to intentionally walk the guy. Maybe that was just to to pad down the other reliever's stats. Like, I'm so confused by this.
All right, get in here, Gene. You don't got nobody who can do it like you.
They're like, there's no one who can throw four wide ones like Gene Garber. So props to you, man. 1974, setting those records nicely.
All right, let's move on. So my next guy, I'm glad you chose a pitcher because I didn't even really look for pitchers. I mostly was looking for position players. So yeah, my next guy, Jose Guillen, 1997 season. It was his rookie year with the Pirates. So, you know, on the surface, nothing really crazy about the guy. I mean, he hit .267. His WRC plus was only 82, which is, you know, it's not what you're looking for, but it's not unthinkable for a rookie who... You know, maybe you're thinking his bat hasn't come around yet, but his glove is there, right? Nope. He was a negative 3.1 WAR player because his defense, according to the FanGraphs defensive statistic, I forget what like the longer name for it for is, but essentially they take like UZR and they like rate it by position so that it's equal across all positions. So for context, Jose Reyes at shortstop this year, by this same statistic, we can all agree Jose Reyes has been an atrocity at shortstop this year. But by that FanGraph statistic, he is 0.9 DEF is the statistic. So that's not great, but it's not, you know, catastrophic, I guess. I mean, I was sick of watching him just let ground balls go like 2 feet to his left. But, you know, teach their own, Terry. Jose Guillen, 1997, he played like 140 games. So. Yeah. They didn't bench him. His defensive statistic by FanGraphs was negative 34.7.
Oh my God.
For a whole season.
Jesus. Yeah. So that's defensive runs above. He was 34. 34 was the stat?
Yeah.
34 defensive runs below average.
That's.
What?
So that made him a negative 3.1 more player. But, you know, he hit .267, right? So you're thinking. Maybe his bat was all right. Maybe they projected that it might get better over his career. So he had 526 plate appearances. Guess how many walks he had? Just guess. Throw out a ballpark number.
21.
17 walks for the whole season.
Jesus.
The same number of double plays that he grounded into for the year. Never want to walk as many times as you ground into a double play, Jose. Not a good look, dude.
No, that's not good. Yeah, that's like on the low end of walks in a season. I was looking through that because I thought maybe I'd use like a season like that. But a walk rate on a season where you're walking like 1.8% of the time, not great. That's below
average.
So
he was walking 3.2% of the time.
Jesus.
That's pretty bad. Aaron Judge is walking like in the 20s.
Yeah, like league average is around 10 or 12. Now it is.
All right, so Jose Guillen, not the best year. Also a weird year. So who do you have for your second guy?
My second guy is slightly less interesting.
Set us up. I'm really hyped now. I'm just at the edge of my seat.
I know, seriously. Well, it's not some bizarre statistical anomaly necessarily, but that's Greg Gross in 1974. The guy finished second in Rookie of the Year voting that year, so he had a decent year. He hit .314. He didn't hit any home runs. In fact, he only
not even one.
No, he hit 7 in his career. This is like Elvis Andrus before Elvis Andrus existed. Except Elvis Andrus has 16 home runs this year, so that doesn't even count.
This year doesn't count.
Yeah, that's so true. The ball is juiced.
Brett Gardner has like 21 home runs. Brett Gardner, future police chief of Nassau County on Long Island, has 21 home runs.
but Greg Gross in 1974 for the Houston Astros, again, really not a strange year, except for the fact that he was caught stealing 20 times and only stole 12 bases. So my guy literally stole bases at like a 38% success rate. It feels like if you steal one and get caught stealing twice, I'm probably not stealing again that season. I'm like throwing in the towel at that point. Like if you're that's so bad. That's you're actively taking away from your team at that point.
I feel like maybe he was missing some signs.
Like maybe he was. Like in theory, you think he's maybe a fast guy. I mean, 32 attempts on a season is pretty reasonable for any guy who can steal a decent amount of bases. And he was okay in the minors. I'm really not sure what's going on here because in his career, in the minors as well, he'd only ever attempted 16 in a year before. So he'd never done anything like this. He was like fine. In his first year in baseball at rookie league, which does that even count? He stole 12 bases and was caught stealing 4 times. And he was in the majors 4 years later and tried to steal 32 times, like out of nowhere, was caught stealing more than half of them and never attempted more than 8 in the rest of his career, like in a season.
Wow. That's really something. I wonder why. We need to figure that out. Let's find some context for that.
Yeah, we should find some context. Let's call him up. He's 65 years old, living in York, Pennsylvania. So let's drive over from your house.
Damn, I'm so down.
All right, yeah, you're the last guy.
Yeah, so I am going to wrap it up with my last, but definitely my favorite of the guys that I have on this list. So I've always had a special place in my heart for the man that is Mark Reynolds.
Of course.
So Mark Reynolds' 2009 season with the Arizona Diamondbacks was definitely one to be remembered. Weirdly enough, he finished 20th in MVP voting, which Baseball Reference is just always doing too much. Like, no one needs to know the top 20 finishers for NL MVP for 2009, but apparently me and anyone who is now listening is forced to know this. But so Mark Reynolds hit 44 home runs, which is like, that's nothing to be trifled with. Like 44 home runs is a lot of home runs. Mm-hmm. But he only hit 260 for the year. Do you want to know why?
Why?
He struck out 223 times.
Good God. The same number of walks that Barry Bonds had in 2004.
Exactly. So Reynolds, for his career, so I did a little more deep digging on Fangraphs about Reynolds because I wanted to know, like, if you're striking out that many times in one season, you have to basically be striking out, like, I don't know, every other plate appearance. So I looked it up. Mark Reynolds is 35th all-time in strikeout percentage for qualified players, and that includes, like, pitchers and everything. The guy who was first of all, struck out 50% of the time, but was still worth like 12 WAR for his career. I didn't really understand that. I need to look deeper into that.
That's weird.
So yeah, he's 35th all time in strikeout percentage at 30.9%, which is insane. He struck out one every 3 times for his career.
Christ.
And he's one of only 7 players in the top 50 of that statistic. So of strikeout percentage for their careers. He's one of only 7 players in the top 50 worth more than 10 WAR. So Mark Reynolds is like a walking conundrum. Like he's been worth more than 10 WAR in his career, which is like, you know, generally nothing, right? Like 10 WAR is not that much. Mike Trout just shits out 10 WAR seasons.
Yep.
But, you know, it means you were like an MLB player for a decent amount of time. Like they didn't kick you out of the league immediately or send you to a career or anything. Mark Reynolds, don't know how you did it, but never change, man. Keep striking out as much as you possibly can.
And you know what? If I recall, he like did change. I mean, he turned his career around, is now a legitimate first baseman for the Rockies. I mean, call it the Coors effect if you want, but the guy's hitting like 280 with 30 home runs on the year.
2017 Rockies. Yeah, 277 and Yeah, 27 home runs. He's been worth 0.9 WAR. His defense is only negative 10.1 defensive runs saved. In this season that I was talking about, though, he was worth negative 11.9. And 2 years later, 2011 with the Orioles, he was worth negative 29.6. So I'm thinking third base was... They finally figured out to stop playing him at third base. He was worth... In 2013, he was worth 7.1 defensive runs saved. So he really turned it around. That was his only positive year. That and once in 2010 for 2.4 runs. So I don't know what it was in 2013. He just... figured it out.
I really guess so. I mean, I don't even have analysis for that. I'm just like, yeah, I guess he got better. Question
the
mark.
Ball just was never hit to him for an entire season. It was just weak dribblers down the first baseline.
Mark Reynolds, man, what a guy. I can't even believe he's still playing baseball, honestly.
Yeah, so that year, so the 2009 year that that I listed as one of my weirdest seasons, he was worth 3.3 WAR. While striking out 223 times.
Jesus.
That's really something.
That is impressive.
Shouts to him.
Yeah, shouts out to him, man.
I remember, like, way back when, like, right around this season, one of my friends from high school, like, one of my buddies that we used to just sit around and shoot the shit about baseball with, he tried to convince me that Mark Reynolds had already struck out 400 times in that season.
God.
He's like, dude, I swear to you, Mark Reynolds has already struck out 400 times this year. And I'm like, there are only 162 games. Like, that's basically striking out every plate appearance. The season wasn't even over yet. There was only, like, we were like 130 games in. He's like, dude, he's got 400 strikeouts. I was like, is he batting 10 times per game?
You know, honestly, if anyone could find out a way to do it, I think it'd be Mark Reynolds.
He'd still be worth positive WAR somehow. Yeah,
somehow. He'd still hit like 40 home runs. So, you know what? He's making it work for him. He carved out that corner in the MLB, and he is just grooving there.
Yeah, shouts to him. All right, let's finish up. Who's your last guy?
My last guy, speaking of Coors and Mark Reynolds and the Rockies, rewind 10 years earlier to a season, the season that kind of got this exercise going for me back when I was searching.
I love this. I love this season.
So what I did was I went to Baseball Reference and I was really curious. I was like, who are players who have hit at least 250 in a season and hit at least 30 home runs and still managed to post a negative WAR? Because I figured that's like a decent baseline. If you hit 250 with 30 home runs, you could be considered that you had a pretty good season. You know, defense aside, stolen bases, strikeouts, whatever, that's generally speaking a pretty valuable player. You know, hitting the five spot, whatever. And I figured that I would come across a few players there. And as a matter of fact, I came across six players who have hit at least 250, at least 30 home runs, and posted negative WAR. And most of them are like a couple ticks below zero. We've got Matt Kemp on here, Adam Dunn, Yasmani Tomas, Joe Carter, and Leon Wagner. And Leon Wagner,
it's my namesake, baby.
Exactly. Who, out of those group, posted the lowest, posted negative 0.6. To give you a little bit of context, you have to understand that WAR, like, there's a base for that. There's a floor for WAR at, like, around 4, which is, I think, the worst season ever, was, like, negative 4 wins above replacement or 4 wins below replacement.
Yeah.
Dante Bichette, in 1999, managed... by Baseball Reference standards, negative 2.3 WAR. The guy hit 298 with 34 home runs, 38 doubles, 133 RBIs. His OPS for the year was almost 900. So by all standards, you could call that quite a productive season. If not for the fact that, and I'm going to bring in that stat that you used before, defensive runs saved or defensive runs above average. Our guy was 40 defensive runs below average. 40. What? That's insane. That puts him, it basically ended up in him having one of the, arguably, in all of the seasons across baseball history, in the bottom 50 by WAR. Simply because of his abysmal defense. He's literally, by WAR standards, it's the 51st worst season in history.
That's impressive.
That's so impressive.
He's the kind of player that, like, defensively, he forces pitchers to, like, make trade requests.
Yeah, seriously. The Rockies' defense that season was generally pretty bad, and they posted, like, career worsts for, like, all their numbers, in part because Dante Bichette was playing left field for them and literally had, like, a 950 fielding percentage, which is, oh, God, that's awful. That's, like, send him back to the minors so that he can figure something out in levels.
That was, like, me in my MLB The Show create a player, like, center fielder before I realized that there was, like, a button that could let you look at the ball and where it was going to land. Like, I was just trying to guess in the air off the bat. I would miss, like, I'd be, like, 10 feet from, like, every fly ball. And every time I'd just be like, damn it, this is so hard. That was Dante Bichette in the MLB for a whole year.
Yeah, literally. He had almost a 380 weighted on base average, which is weighted to, like, you know, normal batting average. So 380 is pretty incredible. I mean, that's a pretty good year, all things considered. But except for the fact that he just could not field a single ball in left field.
Mad respect.
One other thing before we move on from this. I do want to give the honorable mention, despite the fact that we mentioned him in last week's episode. We can't move on from this without mentioning our boy Joey Gallo, who is in the midst of posting a season that no one has ever come close to having. I mean, he literally has almost twice as many home runs as he does singles. Home runs literally comprise half his hits right now. No one else in history has had that spread of things.
Yeah, that was kind of like, that was the first thing that came to mind, but I knew we had talked about that last week, so I didn't want to, like, beat the same drum, but, like, it's, I think the stat last week that blew me away was, like, he was at 35 home runs and only 36 other kinds of hits combined, singles, doubles, triples.
Yeah, that's genuinely so impressive. He has 20 singles in this season. Of all players who have fewer than 30 singles in a season, no one else even has, if I'm doing this math correctly, no one else has more home runs than they have singles, like, at all. Ryan Howard is the closest with 25 home runs and 30 singles. Jesus, come on.
That makes sense to me.
That was actually last year when he hit 196. Oof.
Oh, God.
Those are, like, Joey Gallo's career numbers right there.
I just want to point out, before we move off Dante Bichette, is that how you say his last name? Bichette? Bichetti? Bichette?
Bichette? I like Bichette. Let's just pronounce his name wrong.
Anyway, I just like to point out that, like, as soon as you started talking about him and you brought up his name, my dog was laying next to me on the couch and she just, like, burst up, sat straight up like she was coming out of an exorcism. So, I don't know. Dante Bichette's ghost, Bichette, whatever, is somewhere floating around this podcast right now.
She heard negative 40 runs above average and was like, oh my God.
So when we come back, we're going to have a new segment for you. One that we, like, conceived before.
A new segment, Bobby.
One that we conceived, like, before we even had a name for the podcast, but we haven't had the balls or the preparation to do it yet. So
we, like, came up with the segment and then we were like, hey, maybe we should make a podcast.
California, here we come, right back where we started from. California.
All right, so moving on, we are going to do a segment we're calling Taking All the Way. So essentially what it is each of us has written down three takes that we don't actually believe, but, you know, in general hot take culture, you just got to say what you feel, right? We're Yoenis Cespedes on a 0-0 count with a fastball that he could hit out like 70% of the time.
Yeah, and I mean, he's probably going to swing and miss, but that doesn't mean he's not going to go for it.
Came in to face Cespedes last night and gave up an RBI double to him, and Cespedes taking all the way on the first pitch. It's a strike.
All right, so each of us has written down three takes, and we're just going to go back and forth and see how hot they get. Why don't you start us off?
Yeah, so hot take right out the gate. Colorado Rockies make the World Series this year.
What? This is way hotter than any of my takes. Maybe not. My first take is pretty hot too, but continue. Why? Justify that. 10 seconds. Go.
I don't even know if I can. But you just here's wasted the thing. 4 seconds. That lineup is stacked. I mean, if there's one lineup that can compare to the Dodgers, I think that it's that one. Not to mention, I think they actually have a decently robust rotation. If there's anyone who can take it on besides the Nationals, it's the Rockies. The Diamondbacks certainly don't match up very well. They have Greinke and Robbie Ray, and then I don't really know who else. The Rockies has some fun young guys in there. They could, if things bounce their way in a one-game playoff against the Diamondbacks, they could potentially knock out the Dodgers in the division series. Again, hot take, probably not going to happen, but...
That's the whole point. We don't actually believe this shit.
It's just, it's whoever's hottest. And to be fair, the Dodgers are still the hottest, so they're probably going to win the World Series. But I don't know.
The Dodgers are going to win 100 games before, like, September 15th.
yep.
All right, here's my first take. This take is sponsored by the sitcom that we're launching called Keeping Up with Tim. Tebow is getting called up out of necessity.
Yeah.
So I was looking at the Mets 40-man roster and just their depth charts today. Wilmer Becerra is the only outfielder who's on their 40-man who has not been called up so far and is not on the DL. And he's actually a legit prospect. He's in St. Lucie right now with Tebow. So, like, they're not going to call up him and mess up his development, right? Like, they're not, that's not going to be a joke thing that they call him up and then just, like, send him back down. So, like, honestly, with the way this season has gone, God is working in not even so mysterious ways anymore, because Michael Conforto dislocated his shoulder on a normal swing, which we haven't even talked about on this podcast yet. Like,
yeah.
I'm laughing right now, but inside I'm crying, and probably outside pretty soon if we keep talking about Conforto, I'm going to cry. But yeah, the only solace I can possibly get is if the Mets call up Tim Tebow. Let's do it. We're going to every game with Tebow signs. We're getting Tebow jerseys. We're getting Tebow hats. We're wearing a Tebow Jets jersey underneath a Tebow Mets jersey over top of a Tebow Florida jersey. Let's do it.
Yeah. Honestly, I'm here for it. The only thing is, I don't know what their roster looks like. They'd probably have to clear a guy off the 40-man. I don't know who that would be. TJ Rivera, bye. You're getting the boot. Sorry, it's Tebow time.
It's Tebow time.
You know what? I'm here for it. And we've talked about this. If he gets called up, we're going to every game.
Hey, Mike, first time, long time. At least this guy's not black, huh?
God.
All right, take two.
Take two. This one's more of a long-term one. We're going to go outside the season a little bit. Jose Altuve, I think he cracks the top 10 all-time hits list by the end of his career.
Wow, I like that.
I think he'll get in there.
All right. I respect it. I think you sent me some numbers from that. What were they that you shared with me the other day?
I'm going to just delay here while I am pulling up my Twitter account. If you have some like elevator music, maybe play that right now.
How about Jeopardy? But,
yeah. So real quick, and this, it's easier to understand this if you're reading it. So we'll put a link in the description to the tweet just so you can visually comprehend this nonsense. But through 952 career games, Jose Altuve has 1,219 hits. He's slashing 317, 362, and 453. Pete Rose, through the same amount of games, 1,161 hits. So like 50 hits fewer. And was slashing 302, 360, 424. And
so
Altuve,
close.
Altuve is 313 days younger than him.
He's good at baseball.
He is real good at baseball. And I was talking with my mom about this just the other night, about why he isn't more recognized on a national stage. Even among like casual baseball fans, Jose Altuve seems to kind of go unnoticed. I mean, people talk about Trout and they talk about Harper and they talk about Kershaw, but Jose Altuve, you could make a case for him to be the best pure hitter in baseball right now.
He doesn't even get respected the most on his own team.
No,
Correa and Springer get way more
like
burn in the media than him.
Yeah, and maybe it's a market problem. I mean, he's playing for the Astros, which are not exactly on a national stage, and he's playing on a team that is absolutely stacked to the brim with rising superstars, but the guy is going to get 200 hits in a season for his fourth straight season and challenge for an MVP this year. So yeah. I don't know. I think if there's any player and young player in baseball who's going to challenge to crack that like 3,000 list, get up there in the top 10, it's definitely him.
All right, my take two. So I've already reneged on what I said last week, and my take two is that Giancarlo is going to hit 62, and the Marlins are making the playoffs.
Ooh, Marlins making the playoffs.
Okay, listen, hear me out. This fucks over your first take, because the Marlins are 4.5 games behind the Rockies right now for the second wildcard spot.
Yeah.
Can you believe that? The Marlins are 500.
Yeah, that's wild.
And the only team between them, so, you know, 4.5 games is like not that many, but usually when it's 4.5 games this late in the season, there's like five teams in between them. Nope. It's only the Brewers.
Wow.
So ask me if I believe that Giancarlo Stanton hitting 62 home runs can propel a team past the Brewers and the Rockies 4.5 games up. Yes, yeah. I believe that. Give it to me. Give it to me. Giancarlo put the team on his effing back. There's no one else on that goddamn team anymore. Everyone's hurt. There's no pitching. Dan Straley is the only pitcher I can name on that staff, and that's bad.
You know what? They're going to make it happen.
And they're going to get destroyed by Zach Greinke in the wild card game.
Oh, they're going to get just diced up.
But Giancarlo's going Yadi Molina twice. So.
Oh, definitely twice. I could see them sneaking in there. They have a kind of
at the expense of your World Series team.
At the expense of my World Series team. It's another team right there that kind of has a sneaky good lineup, 2-3-4, which I just want to point out. Giancarlo Stanton is the Marlins two hitter, so at least some team is treating their superstar right.
Thank God.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, if any player is going to put the team on his back and carry them to the playoffs, it's most definitely Stanton.
All right, give me your last take.
All right, my last take is not as hot as our previous ones, but it's one that...
Attaboy, descending hot takes.
Descending, yeah, from hot to cold here. Craig Counsell, Brewers manager, wins NL Manager of the Year over Dave Roberts. And
that's not going to happen, but okay.
I don't, you know what? Hear me out on this. It's kind of like the Steve Kerr conundrum, right? And this is not to discount what these managers have done for their teams, but when you put together a lineup that the Dodgers have, be pretty hard to fuck that up. Now, that said, Dave Roberts is you know, one of those guys who's regarded as a pretty good player coach, and he's made some really crafty decisions, like with the DL and that sort of thing. But Craig Counsell for the Brewers are the team coming into the year who had the lowest projected win percentage by Fangraphs, who are currently above 500. They were projected to be a 436 team coming into the year, and they're sitting at 515 right now, like 3 or 4 games back of the Cubs, the defending world champion Cubs. I mean, they had the division almost locked up for the first half of the year. So if we're looking at managers who have actually done something with a team and, you know, incredibly surpassed their expectations, I could see Counsell slipping in there.
All right, two counterpoints.
All right.
Three counterpoints, actually. Number one, I just personally don't feel like manager of the year in any sport should just be team that exceeded expectations. Like, I don't necessarily think that's always on the manager, A. And B, I don't think that it's any harder or easier to exceed your expectations with a bad team than it is to meet your expectations with a good team. Counterpoint two. Steve Kerr did win Coach of the Year just in the first year that the Warriors were good. He didn't win it this year because they got tired of him.
No. I know.
Counterpoint C, it's the Brewers. No one cares.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, yeah, I was going to make a case for... Shit, who's the Diamondbacks manager? I don't even know.
Over. Case over.
Yeah, it's probably going to be Dave Roberts, but I do think... I think Counsell gets a few votes of his own. Again, not these awards matter at all. I mean, no one sitting here in August on the edge of their seat being like, shit, if we win a couple more, our guy Craig over here might get himself a title in Manager of the Year. Like, the only people who care about this thing are like the managers themselves and their families. But you know what? Yeah, more power to them.
All right.
Last take. Go.
Are you ready for my last take?
Yeah. Hit me with it. It better be flaming hot.
I'm ready to douse the flames of other people with this take.
Oh, wow.
Rhys Hoskins has hit 11 home runs in 18 games. Patently absurd.
He's really 76 good.
76 plate appearances, 11 home runs. Here's my take.
No player has done that before.
He will go another 18 games and 76 plate appearances before he hits one more home run. That's my final take.
Wow. Okay.
Cold streak. Here it comes. I'm done. We've reached coming? The cup has flowed. The cup floweth over with Rhys Hoskins bullshit. I'm sick of hearing this weird dude's name. I'm sick of reading it on Twitter. I'm sick of Cespedes Family Barbecue saying that he's the Giancarlo Stanton is the new Rhys Hoskins. I'm done with it. I'm over it. I'm done. I'm sick of Rhys Hoskins. I want the Phillies to go back to being irrelevant.
All right. So just you think he's going to hit that Aaron Judge cold streak and not
he's hitting the Aaron Judge cold streak. Give it to me. Rhys Hoskins. Coldest hitter. He's going to be the coldest hitter in the NL over the next 18 games.
Now, obviously, you're not. I know that in the stat you were including today on which he hit a home run. So that's starting tomorrow. He's going to be the coldest player in baseball.
Yes.
Yeah. I got no statistical evidence to back that up one way or another or refute it or anything, but why not?
All right. So, yeah. Well, when we come back, it is Tebow time.
Oh, yeah.
All right, we've reached that time in the podcast. Both of us reach our maximum capacity and our maximum delight level.
This gets weirder and weirder every week. Your mom literally texted you saying, I'm worried about you guys and Tim Tebow.
My mom, who we should have had on the podcast.
Yep.
But yeah, so here we are. It's Tebow time, as you like to call it, Tebow mania. As I already alluded to in my hot take, it's keeping up with Tim. What happened this week? What's up with our guy? It's been so long since we talked about him.
Yeah, it has. I can't even really keep track about when we record these episodes, so I just kind of estimate where I'm starting my week.
They're usually Saturdays. Like, yeah. It's only been 8 days since we talked about Tim Tebow, and it feels like an eternity.
Yeah, seriously. That's what happens when we're like thousands of miles apart. It's like Tebow's the one thing that's keeping us connected and grounded.
So true. It's like in SpongeBob, when he has to go work for Plankton, whatever his shit is named, and they're singing that Just a Greasy Spoon song, and the only thing that connects them is their love for the Krabby Patty, you know?
Yeah, we got Tebow.
If you followed along in the most weird, convoluted metaphor I've ever given, Tim Tebow is our Krabby Patty.
Yeah, we're just going to tweet that out as the teaser of the episode. All right, this week, starting on August 19th and running through August 26th, which is 7 days, our guy went 4 for 22.
No, why did he have those two less at bats?
I know, right? So lame. He hit 182 this week. So
that's
better than he hit
last week.
Yeah,
that's improvement.
Yeah, it is improvement. He had a couple nice games. I mean, he had two hit games, and on August 24th, he went 2 for 4 with a double. He had a run scored. He hasn't gotten an RBI in like almost 2 weeks. So I don't really know what he's doing with his life. But he walked a couple times this week, so that's good, I guess.
Showing improvement. I cannot wait to watch him slash like 84, 190, 227 in the MLB for the Mets in left field.
I think that's even being a little nice to him.
I always have just had a soft spot. All right, so there's really nothing left to say about Tim Tebow. We're really, you know, we're keeping this candle burning, but it's getting tough.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to stay optimistic with about him. He was like doing so great through like the first 3 weeks. He was hitting like 270, and now I don't know, man. He made an error this week too. So on the season, he's got a on the season he has a 909 fielding percentage in left field. Oh, wow. My god.
That's really, really not good.
Yeah.
That's really bad.
I mean, I guess it gets a little better. He's 7 for 7 in chances when he plays center field. So maybe, you know what? The Mets need a center fielder now that Conforto's down. I don't know who this Lagares guy is, but Tim Tebow has a 1,000 fielding percentage in the single A right now in center field. So
Lagares, in the short amount of time that he has played this year, Do you want to know how many defensive runs above average he's been worth?
Tell me.
30.4.
Christ.
He's
the
amazing.
Opposite Jose Guillen.
The opposite Tim Tebow, too.
Yeah. Tim Tebow would actually legitimately set a record in defensive runs below average if he was called up right now. He's got to be like at least negative 69.
I hate you. All right, that's enough. That's enough Tim Tebow banter. I feel like every week we reach this point at the end where like, all right, and then you say one more thing, and I'm like, all right, that's enough.
Yeah. And it just gets more and more depressing too. We just like find it was like, oh, he actually did this bad thing also this week.
So share the podcast, download it, subscribe on iTunes, and please rate and review us. We'd love to see what you have to say, what you guys think, or you can just add us on Twitter. That's good enough for us. Also, we would love if you did both. Alex, do you have anything to plug?
Nothing to plug. Just send us suggestions if you have any. Share it with your friends too, trying to expand that network you feel. Tell your friends about us. Get us that rating so that when you search for us, the average rating comes up. I think we have like 2 or 3 right now, and we probably need at least a few more to break that threshold.
Definitely. If you're looking for some fun baseball related reading, I got a story published about Jacob DeGrom, which is cool. It's my pinned tweet. It's about his slider, curveball, sinker, fastball usage. So that was fun. And I didn't bore you guys by trying to talk it at you in this podcast. So I would appreciate it if you read it instead.
Whoa, you're so cool.
Damn, dude.
Yo, if you're also looking for some good baseball reading, my Twitter is @_Baisley. So
now you're just reading your Twitter. All right, this is Mayhem. We're done. All right, thanks for listening.
Bye, guys. Wait, real quick, edit this out. How hot are we taking these takes? Like, mine were kind of hot, but also, like, kind of lukewarm.